Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, welcome. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, multiple reports this week tell us that Britain is failing its children. But how and why, we'll discuss.
And as the Grenfell Inquiry's findings are released to the public, we'll speak to somebody who lost five of their relatives in the disaster and ask why criminal proceedings against those who's deemed to be at fault won't begin until 2026.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, here's the Week Unwrapped.
He has chosen to take the winter fuel allowance away from low-income pensioners and give that money to certain unionised workforces in inflation-busting pay rises. So can I just ask the Prime Minister, why did he choose train drivers over Britain's vulnerable pensioners?
Mr. Speaker, this government was elected to clear up the mess left by the party opposite and to bring about the change that the country desperately needs. Our first job was to audit the books, and what we found was a £22 billion black hole. Well, it's no good them complaining. Richard Hughes, the chair of the OBR, was very clear. He described it as one of the largest year-overspends against forecast outside of the pandemic. His words. So we've had to take tough decisions to stabilise the economy and repair the damage.
Well, as you heard there, Parliament has returned with its usual bluster and bravado. Keir Starmer has defended scrapping winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners, saying his government had to take, quote, tough decisions to stabilise the economy. While Labour have trailed several policies this week, from scrapping the right to buy scheme to improving workers' rights and rumours of tax increases, although we're not quite sure which taxes, if any, might rise. They have been warned, however, with a new survey from the Institute of Directors, a business industry body, suggesting confidence that from businesses in Labour's approach to the economy has started to deteriorate. Ali, what have you made of Labour's first week back in recess?
It's tough. It's definitely tough. I think we'd spoken previously about this upcoming budget and some of the economic decisions that Labour are making and how difficult that might be. I think it's safe to say the honeymoon period is well and truly definitely over for the Labour Party. We've seen, I saw a poll that had us on 30% this week. You don't want to govern on polls, but it suggests that there's a deterioration in support and certainly lively support for the party. That's definitely true. But it's also true that the economy was left in a really, really difficult state. And the decisions that had been made by the Conservative Party has made life more difficult for Labour than they would have liked. That being said, my view is Labour have placed the handcuffs on themselves by agreeing to these fiscal rules. Mm. So the winter fuel payments, the cutting of the winter fuel payments is their big controversial piece over the next sort of 10 days or so. And Sir Keir Starmer has defended it by saying they're having to make tough decisions to stabilise the economy. Those tough decisions are only because Labour has acquiesced to the sort of conservative economic model and their fiscal rules. Because you could easily raise that money through a wealth tax, for example. So they're definitely making decisions. And one thing that you have to give Sir Keir Starmer credit for is that he is willing to make those decisions, whether you agree with them or disagree with them. Mm. I happen to agree with some and disagree with some others. But I think, and this is my prediction that you can hold me to account for over the next 2 months, I think the winter fuel payments and the cutting of the winter fuel payments is not only going to cause serious issues within the electorate, but within the parliamentary Labour Party. Because from what I am hearing, it's very, very unpopular. And I spoke to a fair few new MPs, the new intake, and they're for the first time facing a wave of emails from constituents, and they're starting to have jitters.
Do you think they'll U-turn on it? On the winter fuel allowance?
I don't know. I don't think so, because
you
I think it'll look a little bit weak. But I think what you might see is the first rebellion in government, other than the seven that we saw in regards to the two-child limit. I think you might see some rebellions from the Parliamentary Labour Party, and I think you're actually going to get a little bit of a mutiny from particularly some of the younger ones. You might not hear about it in the news, but I'm certainly hearing about it on the ground, because these are new MPs. They've not had to face public pressure before. They're facing it from pensioners who are quite often very engaged and will vote, and it's starting to make them very, very nervous. I'd keep my eye on the winter fuel payments.
Interesting. Just quickly, before we move on, I want to talk about this proposal or this suggestion that Angela Rayner might rip up the right to buy policy. This was a scheme created under Margaret Thatcher, which allows council tenants to buy their homes from their local authority at a discount of up to 70%. Part of the problem is it meant loads of social housing was sold off and the government didn't rebuild any. So we've got millions of people on council house waiting lists. What do you make of this proposal? Do you think this is quite a good idea?
It's a good idea. The right to buy policy is terrible. It's an awful policy. Yeah. It makes it sound like you're giving people a leg up on the property ladder, and to some degree you are, but what you were doing then is decimating public housing. And at a time when we need public housing, the issue is, so right now, let's make it very, very simple, right? If you live in council housing for your whole life and you pass away, that council house gets passed on to the next family who need it. With right to buy, you've bought that house. That house is out of circulation for the state and for the local council. And unless you are building in excess of the amount that you're selling, which we are absolutely not, it completely decimates council housing. It's a terrible policy. Mm. It's being defended by people who I can only imagine don't know what they're talking about when it comes to this policy. Could not care less if Angela Rayner herself benefited from it. That's not really the point. That's not why we elect politicians to do things that have or will benefit them. It's absolutely right to rip up this policy.
I totally agree with you. I think, you know, it's hangover from a neoliberal era where property was king. And what we're seeing now is that actually lots and lots of people can't afford property.
The key thing with property is stability, right, is knowing that that roof over your head is always going to be there. And with council housing, it is, right, because you get permanent, you get permanently placed in council housing and you get given that stability. That's what's important, not the ownership model.
Well, from Labour to the Conservatives, and the race to replace Rishi Sunak has stepped up a notch.
The social contract of our country has frayed. It is in danger of breaking. And I will do whatever it takes. I will do whatever it takes to repair and rebuild that social contract. That is what our party needs to do.
That was Robert Jenrick, the former immigration minister who topped the first Tory leadership poll, surprisingly, with 28 votes, followed by Kemi Badenoch, perhaps not so surprisingly, on 22 votes. In third place was James Cleverly with 21, fourth came Tom Tugendhat with 17, and fifth Mel Stride with 16, and last, and the one who was knocked out of the race, is Dame Priti Patel, some of you may be pleased to hear, who got 14. Another vote will be held next Tuesday to whittle down the field of candidates to four before the party's annual conference at the end of September. But who is going to replace Rishi Sunak as the next Tory leader? Ali, who do you think will become the next Tory leader? And who would be the worst person to become the next Tory leader?
Well, she's out. So the worst case scenario is gone.
I thought it was going to be Priti. I was sure. So, and then, do you know what this has made me realise? I will never get in the mind of a Tory member. Yeah. And I'm okay with that.
Yes, yeah. I think that's a very safe place to be, is outside the mind of a Tory member. I actually think you're right. I think if it had gone to the membership, she probably would have topped the poll. But the way that this system works is that the MPs will vote on their favourites, and then the final two will go to the Tory party membership, who will get to decide. Who I think is going to be... I think the worst case scenario out of those who are left... is definitely Kemi Badenoch. Yep. And she's the one who's most likely, as in terms of the worst case scenarios, to get through. You have convinced me. I actually thought Tugendhat had a good chance. But you have convinced me over the last 2 weeks that Cleverly is probably the shout that's going to get it. I find it hard to believe that Kemi Badenoch would top the members poll. I can see her maybe topping the MPs' votes. But what we have to bear in mind is that these MPs know what they're doing in terms of how they vote. They don't necessarily vote for who they're most politically aligned with. They're very, very aware about different people's popularity with the membership, because that's who ultimately is going to pick. So I suspect that Priti Patel was knocked out through collective conscience of knowing that she would be very high up on members' polls and therefore needed to be eliminated. So I would say the favourite right now is probably James Cleverly. Worst case scenario is Kemi Badenoch. I wouldn't rule out Tugendhat, No one knows or cares who Mel Stride is.
I was just going to say, you've not even mentioned Mel Stride. Considering this man was trotted out on the morning media round so much by Rishi Sunak in the final weeks,
yeah,
nobody has a clue who the heck he is.
Couldn't pick him out of a lineup, to be honest with you. Robert Jenrick, just listening to his speech now is super cringe. Earlier I was saying I thought it was pretty good, but as I listened to it, it was very, very cringe. He could make the final two, but I don't see him winning. I actually saw someone accuse him. I don't know who it was. Go back and look at it. Someone accused his leadership of being engulfed just by immigration. It seems as he's only talking about immigration.
Yes. I think it was other Tory MPs who had suggested that
he's talking too much about immigration.
Do you want to know my favourite aspect of this whole leadership contest? Is all the accusations that they've been chucking about around at each other about who's on Ozempic, the weight loss drug.
Right, yes.
So this initially started when Robert Jenrick lost lots of weight.
Right.
Back when he was still Rishi Sunak's immigration minister. Yeah, so basically what happened was he lost loads of weight and he got a haircut. And the rumour mill was turning. He's going to launch a leadership coup against
Rishi Sunak. Did he get a haircut or did he get a hair transplant in Turkey?
No, he got a haircut, okay. I think. But it's another good question. Anyway, his staff has denied this, you know, denied it to me. They said they think these rumours are actually very cruel. Okay, a man can lose weight and get a haircut It doesn't mean he's going to try and depose the government.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Anyway, cut forward a bit of time. Tom Tugendhat made a comment in his leadership bid. I've not tried Ozempic, unlike some people. Then Robert Jenrick had to come out and say, OK, yes, I did try Ozempic, but I didn't get on with it. And actually, what you can see here is all a result of hard work, exercise and diet. And then Vicky, what's her name? Vicky Fox? No.
Foxtrot.
No. Vicky Ford. See, just a Conservative MP, also tweeted that she'd done Ozempic. And I thought,
how do you even get your hands on Ozempic?
Well, you have to be prescribed it, but you can buy it privately. But you should really be prescribed it, I think, if you're over a certain weight as a weight loss drug. Anyway, I just thought it was a very funny aspect. I mean, the Tories really should be doing a lot of soul searching, and they seem more preoccupied with who lost weight and how. Which I just thought was very funny.
That's hilarious that he's had to admit to using it, but not
it was. It's very, I smoked but I didn't inhale,
yes,
I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Labour now. And the government is proposing to banish all remaining hereditary peers from the House of Lords in the biggest shake-up of Parliament in a quarter century. The UK's 92 remaining hereditary peers who have inherited their titles from their parents will lose their right to sit and vote in the upper chamber under proposals put forward by ministers on Thursday. The move would complete reforms first made by Tony Blair's government, which revoked the 700-year-old right of all hereditary peers to sit in the Lords in 1999. Just 92 of them, elected from the whole group, were allowed to remain until an agreement could be reached to phase them out altogether. Ali, is this a good move from Starmer? Is it finally time for him to complete what Tony Blair started?
I mean, look, it's very much bottom of the barrel, sort of like the least that you could do to fix the House of Lords. Let's not forget, Starmer was a big abolish House of Lords guy before, certainly in the lead up to his leadership bid and in his leadership bid and beforehand. He had spoken very firmly on the need to abolish the House of Lords altogether, as an unelected chamber, the problems that causes our democracy. Is this a good thing? Yes, but there's so much more that could be done in terms of the House of Lords. It is, you don't realise how ridiculous it is until you have to explain the House of Lords to friends abroad and how it works. Is it finally time for Sir Keir Starmer to complete what Tony Blair started? No, I think it's time for Sir Keir Starmer to complete what Keir Starmer wanted to do, and that's abolishing the House of Lords. But I find that incredibly unlikely.
See, my view on this is that with Keir Starmer and the Labour Party presiding over this vision of social mobility, right, redistribution, you know, taxing private schools, giving more to state schools, free breakfast clubs, trying to give people a better start in life, trying to level the playing field. I think if they continued as normal with these hereditary peers who literally have no reason to sit in the House of Lords except that it is for some reason their birthright, that would be ridiculous. It's like an easy win, as you say. It feels bottom of the barrel compared to some of the things that this country are facing. But, you know, it's a win. There are very few serious people who think hereditary peers are a decent part of UK democracy.
Look, it's a step in the right direction. People like us on the outside are always going to be demanding more and shouting for more, particularly with the House of Cards, because it's the House of Lords, because it's irony, Freudian slip, because it's such a ludicrous anti-democratic system. But it is a step in the right direction. I wonder how much bolder they're going to get over the time, though. Maybe it's a second parliament thing. But we know what Starmer thinks about this. We know what his personal view on the House of Lords is. And the question is whether he's going to expend any political capital on it or not. And I suspect the answer to that is going to be no.
Very interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. That's the week unwrapped. Coming up, the Grenfell Tower disaster inquiry has finally come to its conclusive findings, and it's nothing short of damning for several private companies, the local council and the government, with criminal proceedings expecting to begin, but not until 2026 at the earliest. We'll speak to somebody who lost five relatives in the disaster next.
Foodbar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to Foobar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Foobar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Foobar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The Foobar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be like. They see like the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be like this, like serious, like fuckboy, like lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
You
no,
go, you go there.
Yeah, we're going there. Access All Areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, the Prime Minister has apologised to the survivors and families of the people who died in the Grenfell Tower blaze on behalf of the British state. He said, quote, "When serious failings by those in charge happen over many years, the current Prime Minister, as head of government and behalf of the British state, can give an apology on behalf of previous governments as well as their own. It should never have happened," he said. It follows the release of an important report on the disaster, which happened 7 years ago on the 14th of June 2017, to find out what happened and who was responsible. The report says several parties were to blame for the fire, including governments, dishonest companies, the local council which oversaw the Grenfell Tower, and a lack of strategy by the fire brigade. 72 of the people living in the building lost their lives because of the fire, described as one of Britain's worst modern disasters. The report also gives recommendations on what needs to be done to avoid events like this from happening again. Police and prosecutors have been facing calls to bring criminal charges over the tragedy, but these won't begin until 2026 at the earliest. But speaking today, Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, has said prosecutions must happen as soon as possible. Well, joining us to discuss all this is Ahmed Shalat. Ahmed lost five relatives in the Grenfell Tower disaster and previously gave witness statements to the Grenfell inquiry. Thank you so much for joining us, Ahmed. Now you've had some time to digest the findings. What are your reactions to what the inquiry has concluded?
Well, to be quite honest, it's the same reaction in the phase one. To be quite honest, it's obvious. The outcome is clear. And to be quite honest, disappointed of no one being charged, and the length of time they mentioned regarding, as you mentioned yourself, on the 26th, or what the minister said today, which I didn't hear. It looks like they just pulling a rope to let it die. And it's a negative thing towards 72 people who lost their lives.
Ahmed Ali here, assalamu alaikum. I just wanted to ask you quickly, the report is pretty damning, but I imagine nothing will begin to bring you and your family any level of closure or solace until you see those who are responsible for this held to account. Who are those people? Do you want to see it go as far as politicians, the actual companies involved? What do you want to see happen?
Some of them, I mean, they are names. They blame each other indirectly. Let me tell you this. It's obvious. Fire Brigade claiming it's because of the cuts they got when one of the
coalition government,
whatever his name is, cut down on the fire brigade. The TMO, it's just a puppet of the council. Can you imagine? They wanted to save £600,000 and they spent millions in the carnival. So it's nothing being considered. And the report, the damning report regarding the TMO itself. So the systemic dishonesty is clear. So why do we have to wait till 2026 and or to 2027? The report state clearly who is to blame. So why do we have to wait? Do you understand?
Absolutely. Ahmed, you lost loved ones in the fire. And one of the things the inquiry conclusions pulled out was that the government were warned about this disaster, the potential of this disaster happening 25 years before it struck, with various other similar cases. But also we know that residents inside the building had been voicing their concerns for quite a long time. Do you know, were your family members concerned about their safety before the fire struck?
Well, let me tell you one thing. I had two families living there. One survived and one passed away, demolished completely. My brother-in-law used to live in the 21st floor, which now it's moved to the 22nd. And my sister-in-law used to live in the 9th floor, which she survived herself and her two kids. All right? My sister-in-law was so involved in this issue of refurbishment, of complaints, of misbehavior, of misuse. The TMO never listened to them. And I am part of that state because I used to live in the same state. Greenfield is about 150 yards from where I live. So I'm part of the TMO was the voice of the council. So whatever the council wanted to keep away from, they give us the TMO to fight with. And it was obvious in the report that they blame the TMO itself.
Yeah, Ahmed, can I ask you, the accusation that is being made here at home, which I really resonate to, is that we can't ignore the fact that part of the reason why so many warnings were ignored and such disregard to these people's lives has something to do with the fact that they were working class, the fact that they were very diverse, often in black and brown families that lived in Grenfell Tower. And basically what we're hearing is if Grenfell Tower had been in Chelsea and Fulham, this tragedy would never have happened. Is that something you agree with?
It has been going on for quite some time. Now, let me tell you exactly what happened. It's different than what are you saying? The first 3 days or four, a week after the disaster, two reporters from LBC called me, and they arranged a meeting with two women from Hillsborough disaster. One of them called Susan, and the other one called Margaret. One lost her son, and one lost her husband. Something like this, anyway. So what happened is, they went through, I mean, Hillsborough disaster went through hell. They came and they explained three important things. First, the council would do its best to split up, which I've seen it within the family circles. And they will try to pull the blame away from them as much as they could, which is I've seen it happen.
So they try to turn families on each other?
They did. Mm-hmm. And it's happened to my family. Personally, it's happened to me personally within my family circle. Because I didn't ask for nothing from the council. I only asked for justice. Mm-hmm. Because as far as I'm concerned, until now, those people were murdered. They were not killed. They were murdered in the most safest place in their lives. Mm. Right? So, and that's exactly what happened. What they did, on the top of that, which has made it worse, they approached the people. Most people who are now the council or the Grenfell Voices got nothing to do with Grenfell. And that is, everybody should know this. Because they got these people, God knows, some of them don't have, they're not real believed. They just put them in a picture. And I can assure you this. And this is the council tactics. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it's a building that contains a lot of foreigners, a lot of non-English speakers. And I'll tell you this. When we had meetings with them in parks with bereaved survivors, they were asking them to get lawyers, to get, they were shocked. They didn't understand how the system works. They didn't know what the inquiry means. They didn't know what the inquest means. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the council played a big, big game on these people, and they threw them peanuts. They split between them, and he's the winner. Mm-hmm.
And so the tragedy doesn't end on the night of the fire, but
No.
Well,
it's
afterwards.
It's not going to end. And I'll tell you what is going to happen to me personally. There's going to be no, even though going to be charges, there's going to be no prosecution, whatever, because so far, no one is taking responsibility. Mm-hmm. Mm. That's clear as crystal.
So you have no faith that any prosecutions will happen?
No way. Because they promise us, if we can go back to first when it's happened in June. They said from September, they're going to be arrested. Then the inquiry comes, they sit in the middle of the inquiry. Then they pull it back after the inquiry. Now they're telling us 2027. Mm. Mm. And the worst part of it is this. And last anniversary, I spent the whole day at home watching media, watching BBC, Sky, all the media, and even reading the newspapers. Only tiny, tiny subjects about Grenfell. They killing it slowly. They're killing it. In 5-6 years, there's going to be no such a thing called a Grenfell University. That's how I look at it. I might be wrong, but this is what my feelings are.
Mm-hmm. Ahmed, I'm sure all the listeners, and I know me and Ali are really taken by how passionate you are and how much great work you've been doing on this. Obviously, the report's findings on Wednesdays set out such an array of failures and incompetence and things that had been hidden from people. You say you don't think there are going to be prosecutions. Do you feel like there will at least be lessons learned, or are you worried that these mistakes could happen again?
That's my concern. My concern is two things: justice and not to happen again. Mm. And I please pray to God, pray to Allah, that those things never happen. This cladding, which I've heard recently when I'm here and I was watching the news and I seen it in Dagenham. Believe me, myself and my wife, just
yeah.
it's a remembrance.
Yeah, that must be horrible, right?
Because no one died there.
That's got to be particularly painful, because you're right, there was a fire in Dagenham, and what we're hearing early on is that cladding was a major issue in that building.
Exactly.
So that's going to be very difficult, that these lessons clearly have not been learnt.
No, they haven't been learned. They talk about it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, cladding should be demolished completely. There should be a law to take them off. They're looking at cost, how much it's going to cost them. That's another issue. That's another very serious issue. Take them off. Save lives.
Yeah. Ahmed, can I ask you one last question, if that's okay? And I will personally guarantee that I will send this clip to the Prime Minister. Speaking directly to the Prime Minister, what would family like yours want to see him do?
Justice. And not to happen again. Justice for Grenfell. Justice for the death. Justice for the murder of Grenfell. And not to happen again. That's all we're asking for, nothing else.
That's very powerful.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. That was Ahmed Chalat, who lost five relatives in the Grenfell Tower disaster and previously gave witness statements to the Grenfell inquiry. What a powerful testimony. I've got goosebumps.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
Well, Ali, we just heard from Ahmed there. And I'm sure you'll agree, it was incredibly powerful.
Yeah, it's...
And I think it's going to take some time. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if you read the report or you just saw how incredibly comprehensive it was. It's going to take a long time to digest the findings, but not just that. And as Ahmed said quite succinctly, the web of blame. There are so many places where that could have been prevented. So many people and parties that could have had a role in preventing that.
The thing that's most powerful about Grenfell is obviously that it should not have happened. Mm. You have tragedies in our society that happen all the time, and you can attribute blame, but often, you know, they are tragic incidences that take place. Grenfell should not have happened, and it is, I think Grenfell is, in my generation, the inequality manifest. It's absolutely true that if Grenfell was a private property institution sat in the Chelsea or Fulham, this would not have happened. And what frustrates me is we haven't learned the lessons. This could happen again. Mm. And I am just so utterly frustrated that our society and our country faces tragedy. And we saw this, by the way, we did an interview on COVID-19 where a doctor came on here and said, no, we're not ready for the next pandemic and more people are going to die. We face tragedy and we just move on from it. We learn no lessons and it happens again and again and again. And it's as a result of incompetence, but also a level of corruption. People don't want to be held to account. The political system is far too close to the businesses, sort of the businesses that are involved in the system. And there is a real risk that people avoid accountability. I hope Ahmed and me are wrong and people are prosecuted, but, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath.
What I found particularly compelling was his criticism, I guess, of the TMO, which is the Tenant Management Organisation, which was basically responsible for listening to the concerns of residents in Grenfell. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how his sister-in-law was very heavily involved in the refurbishment and had been one of the people who had, you know, flagged their concerns about whether the building was fire safety compliant, which it clearly wasn't. You know, the cladding was there will be so much about this cladding. It's extraordinary. There are still buildings, thousands of buildings in the UK with this dangerous cladding, and residents are having to pay out of their own pocket to get it removed.
And also, by the way, one of the most tragic things about Grenfell that was spoken about was in the aftermath, not rehousing the families effectively. And also now we're hearing from him, them attempting to turn families against each other.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Because wherever there is blame and cover-up and things like that, you see that the victims are continuously re-victimised. And, I mean, we have the conclusions. I wouldn't say there was anything particularly surprising in there. Everybody knew from what we'd seen throughout the inquiry that there were plenty of people to blame and plenty of people who should have prevented this from happening. But, you know, it's going to take a long time before we even know if there are going to be any criminal convictions. The Metropolitan Police has said it's going to take them 18 months to digest the findings of the report, which, you know, on the one hand, it's great that they're taking it seriously. But on the other hand, how long do victims have to wait?
Yeah, and particularly given how long the inquest took and the promises that were made to those, to the families. I think ultimately, if it takes 18 months, but actual prosecutions are brought in place, I think people may end up looking back and going, okay, a thorough job was done and justice was served, but justice must be served.
Absolutely. What do you think needs to happen next from a sort of government perspective? You know, is there something that Keir Starmer should be doing? Or do you think actually it goes beyond Keir Starmer and it goes beyond the government at this point?
Yeah, well, look, I'd like to see legislation brought into the House of Commons in the name of Grenfell to really tighten up the fire safety regulations, particularly of buildings like Grenfell, protecting the families. I'd also like to see legislation brought in that, that puts in statute the responsibility on government to rehouse these the people. And then most importantly, transparency. I think Keir and the government need to be very clear about when prosecutions may will be coming and what we can expect.
Absolutely. Okie doke, coming up. Is Britain failing its children? Well, a number of reports published this week suggest that we are. From health all the way to education and crime, how do we reverse this trend? We'll discuss that and more next.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, tell us a little bit more.
You wanna go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access All Areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Malani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, a number of reports this week have suggested that Britain is failing its children. The IPPR think tank released a report suggesting suspensions and exclusions from school in England went up by more than a fifth in the past year, raising concerns about children being shifted out of mainstream education into alternative provision. A dossier released by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health says children across the UK are suffering severe damage to their health, including chronic pain, asthma flare-ups, weight loss and developmental problems because of long delays for NHS care. And a deterioration of mental health under 15s has also been cited as a problem in reports over the past few weeks. And this week, Sarah Brown, the wife of former Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown, has written for The Independent, warning that we are not preparing our children well enough for school, with 25% of all new starters now turning up on their first day in nappies, with many unable to recognise basic words. So, what's gone wrong? Where are we failing children and how do we make it better? Joining us now to discuss this is Helen Rafferty, Senior Programme Manager at the Shine Trust, an education charity helping disadvantaged children in the north of England. Helen, thank you so much for joining us. Where do we start?
Hi, great to be here.
Where do we start? What exactly do you think has gone wrong here?
I think, you know, I mean, so it's a very kind of straightforward question, but with a lot of course, really complex answers. And in the field we work with, specifically in education, really, you know, the very best of education can unlock children's potential. It can give them the foundations to thrive in their future lives. It can make sure their kind of needs are met across the board. And really, that's not been happening for several years now. It starts from the sort of earliest years. I think you highlighted Sarah Brown's work this week, which highlighted that the kind of earliest foundations for children and for education and the kind of skills they need to thrive in their lives are not really, there isn't really the support in the earliest years to get those in place. And in the education system, there has been kind of an increasing kind of situation where those needs, many of those needs aren't met through primary school and then into secondary. And the report you kind of highlighted there, which shows this huge increase in exclusions, is really the end consequence of that for children and young people.
Ellen, if I might ask, it seems like, you know, we talk about schooling, but even before the children get to school, that they're facing multifactorial disadvantages compared to maybe previous years, from health, mental health, socioeconomic, food at home, things like that. What do we go after first, or do we have to tackle all these things at the same time?
I mean, if we want to really make a kind of profound long-term difference, it doesn't even really, in a sense, start with children. You know, it starts with parents and families and communities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can start at the point a child is born. We can really make sure that the communities, parents, carers, guardians, and support system around children is in place. We do know what children need to thrive. They need to develop good kind of vocabulary. They need to develop good communication. They need to develop good bonds with the adults and the other children around them, and they need emotional regulation, they need good mental health, that, you know, this stuff, yeah, we are aware of. But really supporting families and parents and carers and communities to provide that for their children from the very earliest years will kind of have this really long-term transformative kind of impact. But I suppose that, you know, the real kind of long-term vision would be that. But I don't think we can sort of ignore or step away from our responsibility from the children who are already further on in that journey, in that kind of journey. There'll be children at primary school right now who may be at risk of exclusion or suspension or some other real difficult times once they hit secondary, which we know is a much tougher time for children than primary school. Meeting those needs in primary, making sure, again, they have the foundations. Some of that will be around literacy, mental health, vocabulary, good relationships. Some of it will be about making sure their families are supported and that they are not living in food poverty. They have secure housing. We can help those sort of primary school children now. And even, you know, we do know that sort of exclusion and lost learning and some of the real challenges that children and young people face can become really profound during the secondary school years, you know, as a kind of a cumulative effect of many things that some students have been struggling with. But really looking at how we start to kind of head on address some of the challenges with mental health, some of the difficulties with alternative provision, and making sure that those students are kind of got back on the right track before they kind of reach adult life it should still be a priority here and now, I think. But you're absolutely right. The long term aim is to really start from those very first foundations. But there are children, you know, who need that support and need some resources right here and right now, beyond that point, where who we should be looking to help.
Can I just quickly, sorry, ask one follow up question? Because we've been monitoring the political impacts of the two child limit as a policy. And what impact that's been having in Westminster. But in terms of actual reality on the ground, are you seeing that that is having a significant detrimental impact?
We don't personally work with the kind of specific impacts of the two-child limit, but we know that one of the biggest effects overall on outcomes, on children's ability to thrive at school, on whether or not exclusion affects them, is poverty. So, and that's particularly true for children who live 80% or more of their childhood in poverty. So they're not actually very well represented, I suppose, in the statistics. You know, it, sometimes poverty looks like a snapshot. What is the situation for a child or a family right here, right now? But we know that the most needy families and the children who are most at risk of not having the outcomes that we want are children who spend 80% or more of their childhood in poverty. And really looking at how we tackle the impacts of long-term disadvantage should be a huge priority, whether that's through reassessing the true two-child limit or whether there are other ways to make sure the needs of those kind of children and families are met. That should be the real area of focus here, I think.
Helen, you've set out so many things that seem to impact you know, children's lives and how children grow up. And it feels like it's one of those things that is absolutely touched by every other policy area. You spoke about health, housing, funding public services, you know, all sorts of things, education, obviously. The problem to me, it feels like there isn't a sort of joined up force at the centre of government that is really taking this into account. It's a bit kind of spread out amongst departments. You know, Department for Education will have a lot of child policy stuff in it, but, you know, it's... Do you think maybe there's something to be said about having, I know we do have a children's minister, but do you think maybe that should be, for example, a cabinet position? So there is that responsibility, you know, right at the, you know, the forefront of government where children's interests are always brought to the table.
I think there should absolutely be a central thinking which puts children
like a department really for children or something, perhaps
a department for children. I mean, we did used to have a department for children, school and families. That was true historically, and there could be some thinking around whether centering children and families in what kind of long-term opportunity looks like makes more sense than just, like you say, working in this really siloed way around education. There's also quite a lot to be said, I think, about looking at the difference between centralisation and kind of localisation of this sort of work. There's some really impactful work happening at the moment, particularly around North Birkenhead and the Liverpool City region, around bringing local communities, local resources, local services and the education system in a kind of across a smaller geography to really work to meet the needs of children and families and communities from all directions. Because you're absolutely right, there isn't a single answer. It is a complex problem. Over on this side, a child who has challenges with literacy will face, you know, difficulties on their educational trajectory. Yeah. But families who are living with food poverty or mental health difficulties, that will also have a huge impact on children. And the most vulnerable children are probably experiencing a huge range of those challenges simultaneously. And the coordination of those services or those inputs and the resources around children and families is really what will make that long-term difference, I think. And like I say, potentially locally as well rather than centrally.
Yeah, on that specifically, Helen, I wondered if I could ask you about regional inequalities as well, because you've mentioned before poverty being a main driver. I mean, I'm seeing in front of me that pupils who are on free school meals are nearly five times more likely to be permanently excluded, which gives us an indication into the sort of the poverty element that plays into the futures of these children. We often hear that there are regional inequalities as well, and it depends on where you are born as to the kind of futures and impacts that you have. What have you seen in that regard in terms of the inequalities impacts that are happening to our children, particularly in the north? Because what we often hear is London gets all the money and the north gets starved of the money. So,
yeah, I think it's a really interesting picture, because actually one of the things we, particularly in education, we look at is the sort of attainment gap. So really headline, what's the difference in outcomes for children, educational outcomes for children who claim free school meals versus children who don't? And we do know for nearly all areas outside of London, there is a gap. Children who, statistically, on average, children who claim preschool meals are less likely to attain well at school than their peers who don't. This isn't true in London. It used to be, you know, 20 plus years ago, the situation in London was much more kind of dire, and children from poor backgrounds didn't attain so well in London, but there was a huge amount of resource, focus, collective energy and work that went into closing that gap. That's not to say there isn't child poverty in London, some of the poorest kind of boroughs in the country in London, but children have on average the same opportunity to achieve. So we know it can be done in a sense. I think the thing that we see, particularly in the north of England, there are bigger disparities between children from kind of poorer backgrounds and their peers in terms of educational attainment. But there's also we're starting to try and understand an additional gap, which again is the disparity for children who have spent a substantial amount of their school life claiming to be free school meals, or areas which have long-term generational disadvantage, and that's a bigger challenge again to address in the north, certainly, and some areas of the Midlands too, actually. But the north has a much higher proportion of areas and a much higher proportion of children and families who live in long-term generational poverty, or who spend the majority of their school life in poverty, rather than just be a snapshot of difficulty or something like that. And that really does take some, I think, systemic and hugely collaborative effort to kind of turn around the opportunities and some of the challenges associated with that.
Thank you so much. That was Helen Rafferty, Senior Programme Manager at the Shine Trust, an education charity helping disadvantaged children in the north of England. Thank you, Helen.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
Well, Ali, in our final few moments, we just heard from Helen there, and clearly a hugely complex issue that I think is just going to, I mean, I see the headlines every week, and I just think life is so getting so bad for children in the UK. What did you make of what she had to say? What stood out to you?
I think it's a little bit overwhelming when you hear the level of barriers that working class children will have to go through: health, mental health, poverty and inequality, schooling, add on top of that the regional inequalities that exist. And it feels like, look, we often talk about politics as about choices, and it feels like children don't have an advocate in government and in our politics. You've seen the level of furor that has been kicked up over the winter fuel allowance for pensioners. And some will say that's because pensioners get to vote, and because they do exercise that vote, that often their issues are at the front. But the reality is, when we look at our politics and the choices that are made in Westminster, children aren't often advocated for. They don't get a vote, they don't get a voice, and therefore we are now facing probably a crisis in terms of a child's life in our country. Add on top of that the ageing population, the fact that people are having kids less as a result of the difficulties that they know that they'll have to encounter. And we have a serious, serious problem. It's depressing, to
be
honest.
Yeah, I mean, we barely even touched on COVID or social media, which are two things that are often cited as having a particular impact on children's health, a really acute impact on children's health over the last, 5 years or so.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a child being in the world now, 5-6 years old, you've had COVID, you've had the mental health crisis, the cost of living crisis, you've got all this regional like, what chance do you have?
And you're being bullied in your bedroom because it's all coming into your phone, which you have all the time. It's just dire. And I would like to see, and I wrote a piece about this a long time ago in the New Statesman, that there is a real case for a cabinet level position for children, so that when those decisions are made about policy, there is someone in the room saying, well, hang on, how does this impact children and what are we doing for children?
Because that's
the furor over pensioners over the last few weeks. I mean, okay.
Well, children can't email their MPs, and I didn't get my free school meal today, or I couldn't concentrate in class because I was hungry. Whereas a pensioner can email if they're cold in their house. Now, no one is saying take the money from pensioners and give it to kids. You're saying give it to both, right? Yeah. But one has a voice and one doesn't. And maybe putting someone in the cabinet specifically for that will give us a way to ensure that those kids are advocated for at the highest levels of government and the highest levels of discussions that are happening. Well, that's it from Politics Uncensored today. A really heavy show, I thought.
Yeah,
today.
It was. Yeah.
But lots of interesting things to take away. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Maloney UK.
And you can find me at Zoe_Grunewald.
And we're headed to conference season, so do keep up with Zoe and I's commentary on what you can see.
Our various japes and jokes.
There
yes.
you go. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foodbarradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.